Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on WCOM-LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. We welcome your comments or questions. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net. And we do have a website for the program, which you can access at home.earthlink.net/radioinvivo. And all of our past programs are archived on that website. And after about a year and a half of doing the show, it's quite an extensive archive on the many topics we've featured, so we hope you will take the time to check that out. And Radio In Vivo is also available as a podcast on iTunes. All you have to do is go to the iTunes site, search Radio In Vivo, and it will take you right to the podcast site where you can subscribe. And, of course, we've always had podcasts available on the station's website as well at communityradio.coop. I'd like to mention that Radio In Vivo and WCOM have benefited from the support of the multi-talented Claudio Oswald Niedvarok. Claudio is a master storyteller and performing poet and author, and he is now one of the latest additions to the roster of DJs here at WCOM. He and musician-composer John Paul McClellan co-host a show called Claudio's Speakeasy here on the station at Tuesdays from 10 to 11 a.m. And I had the pleasure of actually being Claudio's guest just yesterday. So we hope you'll give them a listen. And also check out Claudio's website at www.claudioarts.com. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the CIIT Centers for Health Research in Research Triangle Park. CIIT is a renowned leader in environmental health sciences research and education. For more than 25 years, CIIT has contributed science that guides sound regulatory decisions and protects the health of the public. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank CIIT for its support. And Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and it is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. NESENT's mission is to facilitate broadly synthetic research to address fundamental questions in evolutionary biology by providing an environment for fertile interactions among scientists. Radio In Vivo and WCOM thank NESENT for its support. And last but certainly not least, I am thrilled to announce that another underwriter has lent its support to Radio In Vivo and the radio station, the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, the NCABR has been fulfilling its mission to promote public understanding and support for bioscience research and careers. To learn more about the benefits of bioscience for the future of North Carolina, visit NCABR's homepage, www.ncabr.org. And it also has a clearinghouse of bioscience resources, and that is at www.aboutbioscience.org. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research for its support. And if you are a regular listener to Radio In Vivo, you'll know that we've devoted several programs to genetics and genomics. Well, today we're going to be talking about the products of the genome, the engines that drive all of life's activities, proteins. Joining me today is one of our leading experts on proteins, Dr. Gary Pilak. Gary is a professor of chemistry and a professor of biochemistry and biophysics at UNC Chapel Hill. He received his PhD from Washington State University in 1983, did NIH postdocs at the University of British Columbia and the University of Oxford in the UK, and he has been at Carolina since 1989. Gary's past honors include a DuPont Young Faculty Award and an Underwood Fund Award, and just last year, he became the first UNC scientist to win the prestigious NIH Pioneer Award, a $2.5 million grant over 5 years given to, quote, exceptionally creative scientists who take highly innovative approaches to major challenges in biomedical research. That's according to the NIH. Gary, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
You have been recognized with this very important NIH award due to your development or your contributions to the development. I don't want to tag you as the inventor, unless that is appropriate, of an innovative method of seeing protein activity within living cells. We're going to talk about that in some detail. But to get us started, could you just give us a quick overview of this method and how it differs from previous methods?
Sure. Almost everything we know about proteins comes from looking at purified proteins. Mm-hmm. We take them out of the cell, we make sure, and this is classic biochemistry. This is how biochemistry made progress. Take individual molecules, purify them, see what they do, add other molecules. And that works very well, but now we're getting to the point where we have to understand how they work in the cell. And the cellular environment is quite a bit different from what we find in the test tube.
Sure.
Now, one of the main differences is how much stuff is crammed into a cell. Almost everything we know about proteins now comes from solutions that have just less than a gram of protein per liter. But the inside of a cell, the lowball estimate on protein concentration is 300 grams per liter. Now, what is 300 grams per liter? An egg white, the protein in an egg white is 100 grams per liter. So this is three times more protein than is in an egg white. And so the properties of certain proteins can really change under those conditions.
Sure.
Now, the challenge has always been, how do you study your favorite protein in this sea of other proteins?
Right, right.
And so that's where we've helped develop in-cell NMR.
And could you explain the methodology itself a
sure.
little bit?
Nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy has nothing to do with radioactivity. It has to do with other properties of the nucleus. That is how they interact with magnetic fields. So if you put a nucleus in a certain nuclei into a magnet, it'll give you information about the structure of the molecule it's in. And the trick for this in-cell NMR is that we feed the cells only nuclei that we can detect by NMR. And then only then do we tell them, because we've manipulated them, to make our favorite protein. So they put these NMR detectable nuclei into our protein on our command, and that's how we can detect our favorite protein, whatever that is, mm-hmm. in the sea of other proteins.
So you're playing God with these cells.
We play God with proteins every day. I mean, what's one of the reasons I got into molecular biology and protein chemistry is I realized that we could have our way with these proteins, and that's how you learn things. You learn things by changing one particular variable and mm-hmm. then examining it.
Right. Now, NMR is a process that's been around for quite a while, has it not?
Yeah, since about the end of World War II.
Okay, so this is a really just a refinement and a brand new application of long existing technology.
It's an application of the technology. It still surprises me that it works, but it does.
Well, having read some of the articles about you and your work, It sounds like it's not far from automatic, that there's a lot of hard work and trial and error involved in actually getting this to work and work consistently for you.
Oh, yes, absolutely. We've tried many proteins. We've tried five or six times as many proteins as we've managed to make work. Now, the ones that don't work, we're not exactly sure why they don't work. Mm-hmm. But we've got ideas. But, of course, now with this Pioneer Award, we can figure, we now have the the headroom to find out what's going on.
Right. Well, you anticipated my next question, really, and that was the, what will this generous funding provided by the NIH Pioneer Award allow you to do that you might not otherwise have been able to do or might have taken substantially longer to do?
Yeah, okay. This is, we have made in-cell NMR work in bacteria, in prokaryotes. In fact, Escherichia coli, the organism we know most about.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the trouble is E. coli doesn't get sick. And so the NIH...
just makes us sick.
Right. Well, we have to have it. But right. but the bad guys can make us very sick.
Sure.
So the NIH really isn't interested in E. coli. So obviously, if we're interested in human health, we want to move into cells that are more like our own. So the push here with the Pioneer Award is, I said, I was going to move in-cell NMR from bacteria to eukaryotes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And
could you define eukaryotes?
Eukaryotes are cells that have a membrane around their DNA, that have nuclei. And, low down, that starts with yeast, and the top of the food chain, it's us. Whereas bacteria, they're some would say they're a more primitive cell in that they don't have organelles.
Right, okay. Mm-hmm.
And so what we're doing right now, right this very second, when I was in a lab this morning, we are trying to push in-cell NMR into eukaryotic cells, and that's a big change for me. The PILAC lab has never worked with higher eukaryotic cells before. And so we had to buy all this equipment to make that work. Mm-hmm. And to hire people who knew more about this kind of thing. I had to find people who knew about cell biology, who wanted to learn NMR.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to find people who know NMR and want to learn about cell biology. And so that's where we're heading right now.
I see. And so what is this ability to use this method in eukaryotic cells going to tell us that we would not have known before about some of these favorite proteins?
Right. So the proteins we're working on are important in human diseases. They're called intrinsically disordered proteins, and they are involved, at least, in Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease, and other kinds of neurological diseases.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to have to digress and talk about proteins. Is that okay?
Sure, absolutely. Okay. We've got a whole hour.
Sure. So when one teaches biochemistry to undergraduates, and we talk about proteins, call them the robots of the cell because they do most of the work. But the kind of proteins we teach about are the ones we know most about. They're called globular proteins. And globular proteins are named that because they are shaped like globs of material. Of course, they're only hundreds of atoms or hundreds of atoms across, so they're small, but they're still globularly shaped.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they are extremely well packed on the inside. In other words, they're linear chains of amino acids that fold into a compact state. And it's that structure that comes, every molecule has the same shape. And it is that shape that gives them their activity, because most of these proteins are enzymes, which means they catalyze chemical reactions.
I see. I was going to ask you that very question about why folding and structure in proteins are so important to their function.
Right. It's because of the structure-function paradigm. In other words, the way enzymes work is they stabilize the most unstable state on the pathway of the reaction. And to do that, they have to have a special structure where they poke certain parts of themselves into the substrate so they can mount this transition state and lower the energy and make the reaction go.
Mm-hmm.
So it is only because they have the specific structure that they can pull and stretch the substrate to the high energy form that allows the reaction to occur. And so that's what we teach about. We spend almost all our time on those kind.
Sure.
The globular proteins.
Mm-hmm.
And
but they are not the whole story.
Right. And now this goes back to a guy. when I was younger, when you would isolate or try to isolate a protein and you'd look at it by NMR and you'd see that it doesn't have any structure, the next thing you would do is throw that one away and go on to the next protein. Also, if proteins aggregated while you were trying to look at them, in other words, that we'd call it snowing in the tube. In other words, that the solution would start clear and then this stuff would come out of it. We'd throw those away.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that protein aggregation is now, it's found to be important in all these neurodegenerative diseases. So it's important now to study these proteins we threw away.
Sure.
It also turns out that many of those proteins that aggregate are intrinsically disordered. And back when everyone was poo-pooing this kind of research, there was a guy named Keith Dunker. And Keith actually taught me a couple of courses when I was a graduate student at Washington State. He said, why would nature select for proteins that don't have any structure? Because after all, we're all taught that structure exists to give rise to the function, to poke those things in there. So,
right. So
why would evolution hold on to something that doesn't have this? And he's been working on that ever since, and he's made this incredible observation, now that we know the entire human genome, that it's on the order of 20% of all proteins in the human genome are predicted to be disordered.
Is that right? 20%?
Yes. And we've totally ignored these proteins because they're difficult to study.
Sure. Sounds like those are the ones we really need to be studying.
And we need to study them under physiologically relative conditions as well.
Absolutely, sure.
Because let's compare now globular to intrinsically disordered proteins. Globular proteins are very tightly packed on the inside. In fact, they're almost as tightly packed as you can pack bowling balls in the back of a pickup truck, which is 74% of the volume filled with spheres.
Mm-hmm.
Proteins weigh in at about 70%, so they're almost perfectly packed. So, Ernie, when we put those under crowded conditions, nothing much happens to the structure. In other words, you can't squeeze them. You might imagine that when you crowd something, you'd make it smaller.
Right.
But globular proteins, they're already as compact as they're going to get.
Sure.
So although the thermodynamics changes, and we don't want to talk about equilibrium thermodynamics at this time of day because it'll just put everyone to sleep, it doesn't change the structure. Now, intrinsically disordered proteins, in dilute solution anyway, in just water, they don't appear to have any structure. In other words, they're kind of chains that are spread out.
I see. Mm-hmm.
You crowd these things, and stuff happens. They get smaller. In fact, you change their environment at all and things happen. When you teach about globular proteins in class, you say, look, if you take a globular protein and you change how much acid is in the solution, nothing happens until you reach a certain level where the fertilizer strikes the ventilator and everything and the protein just falls apart. Same with temperature.
Mm-hmm.
But intrinsically disordered proteins have this, they have a, you tweak the environment even a little bit, and their properties change. So let's put this all together. Intrinsically disordered proteins are involved in disease. They don't have much structure in dilute solution, but they're affected by their environment. So those are the ones that are going to be important to study under physiologically relevant conditions.
And those physiologically relevant conditions are, what are they looking like inside living cells?
Right. And we have two tracks in the lab. We look at them in cells, but people will say about the in-cell work, they'll say, it's just so complicated how we ever unravel everything. So mm-hmm. anything. Mm-hmm. So we also have another track where we make fake crowded solutions, which are crowded with only one thing, with only one other protein.
So you're setting up models,
right?
In other words.
Well, think about it. Even our in-cell NMR is a model because we're multi-cell organisms. We're looking at only one kind of cell. So we're just moving the model from, we're making it more and more realistic, which is the way science goes.
Sure, sure. So now I understand that the model cell you've been using is frog oocyte?
No, we were going to use frog oocytes.
Okay, we've moved away from the frog eggs.
Well, first off, it turned out that I would need, there's a lot more paperwork involved working with frogs. And the other thing I've met some other people who are working on frog eggs, and it turns out to be, you can only push that system so far.
I see.
And so I've decided.
I didn't know if you'd run into the Save the Frogs Foundation.
No. In fact, the frogs survive having their eggs taken out of them. That's not a problem. You can,
sure.
As I understand it, you just keep them in the refrigerator, and they'll last for a long time.
There you go.
Now we've decided to move into yeast because yeast is the simplest eukaryote. Our friend Saccharomyces cerevisiae and another species.
Mm-hmm.
And then insect cells, because they're easy to work with, and the next higher up on the food chain. CHO cells, Chinese hamster ovary cells, and then some human cells.
I see.
But they're all able to be propagated in the laboratory rather than being primary culture kinds of cells.
So when you're conducting these imaging studies in these living cells, what information are you gleaning?
We can glean how compact the protein is, which is important because, as I was saying, that it's clear that it's going to change. It's going to change how big the protein is. We can look at the environment, the chemical environment, on a residue by residue basis. We can tell how fast the protein moves in the cell. We can tell how fast part of the protein moves with respect to another part of the protein. We can look at...
Is that so-called protein-protein interaction?
We can look at protein-protein interactions as well.
Mm-hmm. So, and all of this information, I assume, is much more fruitful than looking at these same proteins in the dilute solution as you had to in the past.
That's my hypothesis, anyway.
We hope so.
Yeah. I've got five... It's a swing for the fence. It's a swing for the fences project, and I'm so glad that I'm in a position to find out whether it's really going to work or not.
Well, we have all confidence, as does the NIH, obviously, that it's going to work. And it sounds like down the line, when you are able to really start pulling some important information out of all of this, there's going to be a lot to learn about. You mentioned that these intrinsically disordered proteins are involved with particularly neurodegenerative disorders such as Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. What is the tie-in there? I know that particularly in Alzheimer's, we see, buildup of, I guess it's proteins, in deceased people, in postmortems. Is the same thing happening in Parkinson's?
Yes, the difference between Alzheimer's and Parkinson's in that respect is that in Alzheimer's, the protein aggregates are outside the cell. In Parkinson's disease, they're inside the cell.
Mm-hmm.
Why? I mean, nobody knows.
Sure.
But for in-cell NMR, if you want to find a drug that prevents aggregation, for instance, well, if you're looking for that drug in dilute solution... It's like that old story of someone sees someone looking for a quarter on the street at night under a street light and says, "What are you doing?" He says, "Well, I'm looking for my quarter." He said, "Well, did you lose it here?" "No." He said, "No, I dropped it down the street." "But why are you looking here?" "Well, because there's light here." In other words, you've got to look at the right place for these things. And
yeah. So the ability to look in the cell, in the living cell, is the right place.
Yes.
In your analogy. Well, that's going to be very exciting. It sounds like you have a lot of work to do, and I appreciate you taking even 1 hour out of the lab to come tell us about it.
It's fine. I love it.
Well, how will this this potential new knowledge, contribute ultimately to our understanding of some of these disease mechanisms and pathologies, or in your hopes, at least?
Right. One. It'll lead to new screens for drugs, screens that appreciate the fact that this protein's going to have a different conformation or set of conformations in cells than outside of cells. Also, it'll just tell us about the properties of these intrinsically disordered proteins. You know, if we roll back the tape a minute and think about the name, intrinsically disordered protein, that's probably not a very good word for it. They're only called that because when people purify them, they don't appear to have any structure. We know from some of our work already in Escherichia coli that these things not only get compact, but they gain structure. So they're a lot of them probably aren't really intrinsically disordered proteins inside cells.
Mm-hmm. So when they are inside cells, why are they pathological, potentially?
Okay. So now we have to talk about why would intrinsically disordered proteins aggregate, which is this, because aggregation probably has something to do with the disease.
Sure.
After all, the aggregates are found in the disease state. Of course, mm-hmm. we could just back off another second and say there's two arguments there.
Is it cause or is it effect?
Right. In other words, are the aggregates bad, or are the cells doing everything they can to shovel off these bad things into aggregates? And people are still arguing about that.
Sure.
But why should they aggregate? Well, again, let's go back to globular proteins. Globular proteins, they tend not to aggregate, but that's because they tend to hide their insides as much as possible. In other words, when you go from something that's all stretched out, where all the side chains of the amino acids are exposed to solution, and if you fold the protein, if you compact it, it buries all that stuff inside, the protein's very happy because it buries the hydrophobic groups, the groups that don't like water.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Intrinsically disordered proteins, well, if they're stretched out a little bit, they obviously don't like themselves, because if they like themselves, they'd compact and be like a globular protein. So instead, they find the molecule next to them, which has also exposed its hydrophobic groups, glom onto that, and the next guy, and the next guy, and the next guy, and before you know it, you've got a protein aggregate. And so that's probably one reason that intrinsically disordered proteins are associated with aggregation.
And are associated with disease.
Right.
This, you know, maybe it's a stretch here, but your description of this sounds like a cancer pathology. Is there any analogy there or association?
Well, there's no direct association, but it's really these intrinsically disordered proteins are fascinating. Most of them are involved in signal transduction. And many kinds of cancers are involved in aberrant signal transduction.
Sure. Now, let me stop you, if you wouldn't mind defining signal transduction. That was coming a few minutes later, but I know that's a term that many of our listeners may not be familiar with.
Cells and you and me have to know what the guy next door is doing, mm-hmm. or the cell down in your foot. And so that means signals have to be transmitted somehow.
Right.
And those signals usually start at the outside of the cell. Well, they have to start at the outside of the cell where the cell can feel around, and they end up in the nucleus. And the nucleus is where the DNA is, and the signal comes in and says, you know, either make me this protein or chop up this protein. And many intrinsically disordered proteins are involved in transmitting that signal from the outside into the nucleus and then back out from the nucleus to get the job done. So there's no direct association between aggregation and cancer that I'm aware of.
Okay.
But these intrinsically disordered proteins certainly are involved in important aspects of the transduction of signals.
I see, and I want to talk about that a little bit, in a little bit more depth in just a little bit, but I want to ask you a little bit about the methodology itself. Has there been you say this is a new application for NMR, but as we've discussed, it was not an easy thing to accomplish. Technologically, what have you been able to do to perfect this and make it actually work? Have you increased resolution or anything like that?
From the hardware side, we really haven't. We haven't had to do much.
Okay.
A lot of it was the molecular biology, to get enough protein in the cell to detect, because NMR is not one of your most sensitive techniques.
Right.
And just preparing the samples. I should say that the instruments that we use, the sample that usually goes in there is a clear liquid. The samples we put into the NMR look like a vanilla McDonald's milkshake that has been put on your dashboard overnight. You can imagine what the thickness of that. That's yeah. exactly what they're like.
Wow.
And mm-hmm. so it was getting all the parameters to be able to attain these spectra, get the right number of cells, the right amount of protein in each cell, making sure the cells are alive, making sure the proteins leak out. Tons of graduate student hours went in, and undergraduate student hours went into making this whole thing work.
A lot of sweat equity.
You betcha.
And have you also had to refine methods for separating signal from noise? Because it sounds like you're going to get a lot of noise with that milkshake sitting there.
Well, the secret to separating the signal from the noise is getting the bug, getting the cells to only put, for instance, nitrogen 15 into our favorite protein. And that, again, that's molecular biology. We grow them up. We grow the cells up to middle age. So they're kind of fat and happy. And then we pellet them, get rid of all their food, and replace it only with food that has N15. Then we tell them, because we've manipulated them, make my favorite protein. So now they must put the nitrogen 15 into our favorite protein. And that means that our favorite protein has N15. Everything else has N14. N14 is not detected by NMR. And that's the simple secret of the whole thing.
So you're actually controlling what the NMR is looking at to reduce any possibility of noise.
Right. And believe you me, there are systems that we can't look at because they're all noise.
Uh-huh.
You know, we can't get enough protein, for instance. Or the protein that we express blows up the cell. Or the protein we express binds totally to membranes. It turns out that if your protein binds to the cell and moves with the cell, we can't see that either. So there are so many things that can go wrong. Like I said a while ago, I'm still amazed it works.
Well, we're certainly glad it does. My guest on Radio In Vivo today is Dr. Gary Pilak. And Gary is a professor of chemistry and a professor of biochemistry and biophysics at UNC Chapel Hill. And an expert on proteins. And we are discussing this new methodology for looking at the workings of proteins in living cells. Gary, one more question I had about that was, are you able to monitor these activities on a temporal basis? Can you make a movie of what's going on with that protein of interest?
Yes, we can. These things, what we get out are not actually three-dimensional structures as a function of time, but we can get out the dynamics of the protein as the function of time and could make a movie of that. Mm-hmm. And yes, as long as that's another trick, Ernie. You got to keep these things alive long enough to do that kind of thing.
Sure.
So we do look at things as a function of time. We can do the protein dynamics, which requires hours and hours and hours of NMR time. We can look at protein stability again, but we've beat some of these challenges in E. coli, but E. coli are the training wheels of cells. We're going to face some big hurdles here now that we're working with eukaryotic cells.
Because they are far more complex.
Yes, and they require much more special care and feeding. You know, E. coli, think about it. E. coli are the major bacteria in our guts. Our guts are anaerobic, and there's a lot of E. coli in there. And if you compare that to how we treat them, put them in an NMR tube and leave them in a magnet for a day, that's just about like the inside of your intestine.
They don't mind.
They don't mind. They love it. But higher eukaryotic cells are going to require oxygen, and they're going to require much more defined, much more complicated media.
It also occurs to me, and I think I saw some allusion to this in reading about some of your work, that it would be of great interest to test various perturbations of that controlled environment to see what the effect of an environmental insult, whatever it might be on the function of that protein. Are you doing anything like that?
Well, we want to. I mean, we're working on that. But yes, oxidative stress. It turns out that Parkinson's disease is associated with oxidative stress. Mm-hmm. And we certainly plan on stressing the cells that way. I was talking about drugs before. Of course, the drugs, that's a perturbation.
Sure.
Feeding them different, after you label the protein, changing the metabolites, the metabolism, and seeing what happens. All these things are open once we make the initial experiments work.
I see. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the Parkinson's and Alzheimer's proteins. You are quoted in one of the pieces I saw as saying that those proteins are, quote, very strange. What exactly did you mean by that?
So we got to go back to that, to the beginning of our discussion,
okay,
where I was talking about globular proteins. Mm-hmm. And I say they're strange because I was raised in the days where you had globular proteins and then you had some structural proteins, but most of what you learned was on these proteins where if you change the properties, if you change the level of acid or the temperature, nothing changes about globular proteins until they just give up and everything changes.
Mm-hmm.
But these intrinsically disordered proteins are strange because you tweak a property just a little bit and their properties are going to change a lot. And that's what I mean by strange. Now, hopefully, when our kids are taking protein chemistry, they won't think that's strange at all because they'll be taught about these kinds of things.
And there will be much more understanding of these kind of things thanks to the work of people like you.
Yeah.
We talked a little bit. I do want to talk about the diseases a little bit because, you know, part of the NIH Pioneer Award, it's a significant part of the NIH roadmap, which is dedicated to translation. What are the potential possibilities for translation that could end up emerging from this work? And I know that's probably, in this case, you know, significantly down the road. But
that's really a pie in the sky. I've been extrapolating to infinity up to now. I have to go to the next infinity here. Well, with some advances in NMR, you might be able to image proteins in cells in organisms.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
I'll have even less hair than I have now, I think, when that happens. I think with the NIH Pioneer Award, it all has to do with translational medicine, but I think they were looking from this particular project to swing for the fences and show us that you can get high-resolution information about proteins in cells. And that if that works, that certainly will be... I don't know who's going to translate that into a practical application, but it will have a practical application.
Sure.
Did I dodge that question well enough?
No, that's fine. That's fine. Because, you know, this is basic science, and basic science is extremely important and needs our support and needs our support with our tax dollars, too. And people, I think, sometimes in the frenzy for, you know, what's the next thing you're going to bring to the bedside, potentially start to lose sight of that.
Oh, yeah. You've hit a topic that I feel very strongly about, and that is that we do have to keep some eggheads in the laboratory doing these pie-in-the-sky, swing-for-the-fences. I think that the taxpayer gets a lot of bang for his or her buck in this kind of research. If you look at most of the big discoveries over the last 60, 70 years, when government's really been funding science, you know, oftentimes, Ernie, it's not the gigantic laboratories that are really dedicated to moving absolutely a cure for cancer. It's the small laboratories with a few graduate students, a postdoc, and some undergraduates working on far-out hypotheses that, bang, they hit it. Because I think a lot of the most important things we've learned, they've come from testing simple hypotheses and not saying, I'm going to just absolutely cure cancer.
Sure.
And we can't lose sight of that. We can't lose sight of it for another reason. And that is, if you just go with translational medicine, then you don't really have to train scientists, do you? You have scientists, and you use them for this. But you have to ask yourself, where do scientists come from? Mm-hmm. They don't come fully formed from Zeus's head. you've got to get an interest in these. Hopefully, they have some interest in high school. But then, when they hit university, they have a chance to actually do some research in the lab. And that's where you've got to capture them.
Absolutely. And I know that's one of your topics of great interest and passion, that you made a point to communicate to me that we need to talk about the fact that you still are in the classroom teaching undergraduates.
Yes. When I teach, I often teach Chem 101. And the great thing about teaching Chem 101 is, first off, all the chemistry is simple, so I can even do it at 8 o'clock in the morning. And secondly...
You can phone it in.
Right. And secondly, I get to look at all their marks, all their grades. I'm grading their exams. So what I do is, after the third hour exam, I look at the top 10, and I offer several of those people places in my laboratory to do research. And boy, this has worked out really well. UNC has got some great undergraduates.
Yeah, that's terrific. And that sounds like a wonderful method that should be emulated in terms of beginning that mentoring process.
Okay, now, but let's play this back. If you look at the way the university is going, a professor has to spend so much time writing grants that they say, I can't teach that much. And also, when they obtain a lot of money, oftentimes they're excused from teaching classes. So we're getting this, there could come a time where there is a disconnect and we're no longer training scientists. I think it's important for undergraduates to see, to be taught by professors who are doing research. The instructors we have at UNC are just fine, but I think it's important to keep professors in front. But the trouble is, there's hardly any reward for doing a good job at teaching.
Sure.
If you get a big grant, or you continue and you continue to get big grants, that's where the pay raises come from.
Right, right. Well, and I know that many people I've talked to over the years, they get that big grant, and it's, thank God, I don't have to teach anymore. I can spend my time doing science.
Well, I got into academia because I liked teaching and doing research and training students, and I hope I'm not becoming a dinosaur.
I hope not, too. You mentioned earlier, Gary, that the fact that just in your work, it's very multidisciplinary, that you have to draw on a variety of expertises to accomplish what you're trying to accomplish. Is that something that you're trying to reach out, even at the undergraduate level, as you bring, you know, promising students in to say, okay, well, maybe you'll go into this branch and you'll go into this branch, but you can all come back and we'll look at proteins?
That's exactly the way I like to do it. First off, I should say UNC is a great place to be, because if I need to know something about Chinese hamster ovary cells, like, you know, bingo, Gene Cook, expert in biochemistry. If I need to know something about a bioreactor, which is what we're going to need to keep these eukaryotic cells happy, Jeff McDonald in biomedical engineering, an expert. So getting big picture help and getting people to work with you at UNC is great. And undergraduates are a clean slate. So, they usually just know they want to do research. So I often put my undergraduates on the most difficult projects, because if the projects work, the undergraduate gets a great experience. If the project doesn't work, the undergraduate still learns what a controlled experiment is, you know, how to use a pipette man, how to use an NMR spectrometer. Now, if compared to the graduate students, well, their main goal is to earn a PhD. Mm-hmm. And so you've got to keep them on a project that will lead, or you think will lead, to a PhD. So that's why a lot of the strangest experiments I've done, and some of the most important experiments the Pilock Lab has ever done, they've been done by undergraduates.
Well, that's very interesting, because the incentives are different, and for the undergraduate, it's perfectly okay if they fail.
Right, because they want to learn what science is about. Mm-hmm. And I tell you, you better learn about failure in science. I tell my students, if 1 out of 10 experiments work, it's probably an artifact.
No, I think we can give you a little bit more credit than that. Because, part of this comes with knowing where to look and what to look at, and having that scientific creative imagination, even.
Well, and every result is trying to tell you something. You know, people say, oh, the experiment failed. I say, no, hold on. The experiment didn't fail. It didn't tell you what you wanted to know. You didn't, your hypothesis was wrong, or something else was wrong. Let's look at what these data are trying to tell us.
And that is part of the scientific process itself, absolutely.
Yeah.
That failure can be just as informative as success, right?
Yes, well, as long as you... What is science about? Science is about testing hypotheses. And so that's just how you go at it.
You were talking a little bit earlier, Gary, about the role of oxidative stress. And this is something that maybe it's just me, but I'm seeing a pattern that's really starting to develop, with oxidative stress being involved in many, many, many of our most serious diseases. Will the imaging method that you're working on be able to tell us anything new about oxidative stress itself?
Sure. If the protein becomes modified, we'll be able to see that in the chemical shifts of, okay, of the residues. If the protein aggregates, we'll be able to see that because our data will begin to degrade. But as far as oxidative stress goes, I think that in the bigger picture, we've got to step back. We've been so fixated in the last 50 years on DNA, mm-hmm, that we've kind of lost track of protein chemistry in the purest sense, you know, the chemical modification of proteins. And I'm sure that oxidative stress involves not so much changing things on a DNA level, but modifying the proteins that you have in you, or modifying the membranes. But I'm a protein chemist, so I'm going to stick to the proteins.
Sure.
And I've got another small project going on in my laboratory where we're looking at the aggregation of the protein involved in Parkinson's disease on just exactly that level. Right now, not using NMR at that level, but looking at the covalent aggregation. And I think we need to put more emphasis. We need to back up and say, how can we characterize these chemically modified proteins? And what are the major reactions that oxidative stress, how does that change the covalent structure of proteins? Somebody needs to focus on that again. It's not a sexy kind of experiment, but it's a very important one.
Well, it sounds like that is maybe ground zero of where disease is arising, turning from potential for disease to disease.
Yes. And it all has to do with that nasty molecule, oxygen. Mm-hmm. You know, oxygen, if you pump 4 electrons into it, you get water. And that's what we do. We convert oxygen to water. But if you screw up and you only put in 1 or 2 electrons, you make these free radicals, which are really bad. And even, 3 billion years of evolution, we still haven't conquered that problem. And so what you have is when the metabolism of oxygen changes such that you make more free radicals, those free radicals react with proteins and other molecules, and you got problems.
Absolutely. Big problems in some cases. Gary, what... pie in the sky question for you. You're a pie in the sky kind of guy, I think we've established. What would you do if the NIH suddenly had a windfall and said, Gary, we'd like to send you another $3 or $4 million?
Well, boy, after I sobered up, wow, that's a...
Or maybe you win the lottery. How's that?
Yes, okay. I'd have to buy a ticket, but that's another story. What sure would I do? You know, I think I'd start using NMR to look at the metabolism of smaller molecules in cells. Now, this has a lot to do with the influence I've had from our collaborator, Jeffrey McDonald. But in other words, right now I'm fixated on looking at large molecules in cells, mm-hmm, but I think we could look at small molecules in cells, and we could use something like RNA interference. In other words, we can chemically turn off genes.
Sure, sure.
So chemically,
gene silencing.
Gene silencing. Grow up a bunch of cells, silence a couple of genes, and look at what happens to the small molecule metabolites.
Okay, so now give us some examples of the small molecules you're talking about.
Citric acid in the citric acid cycle. You know, glucose, pyruvate. All these very basic molecules, because mm-hmm, I can't help but think that some of these disease states, like cancer, a lot of their properties has to do not only with macromolecules, but also with small molecule metabolism, and I don't think we just haven't studied that very much. It's, again, metabolism was something in the 30s and 40s and 50s we studied the heck out of in this all over the world. But now we think we've got it figured out, Well, I think it's time for the next step, because we have much better instrumentation to chase down these things now. Things that people could only imagine when Krebs did his work.
Well, you mentioned metabolism, and metabolomics is one of the so-called omics sciences, as, of course, is proteomics, and we were discussing that a little bit before we went on the air. And one thing I did want to ask you about is kind of put your work in the larger context, perhaps. Does it fit into what could be called proteomics? And how does all of this fit into a systems biology approach?
Right. Okay. If you think about how our discussion went, the proteomics came at the beginning. It had to do with that nut, Keith Dunker, who was looking at these proteins that everyone else ignored. Mm-hmm. And that was, heck, Keith was doing proteomics before they called it proteomics. He was looking at these proteins that didn't appear to have structure and asking why.
Right.
And then, after we had the sequence of everything, he went in and identified those. So, I would like, one thing we're doing now is looking at intrinsically disordered proteins associated with disease, and a lot that has to do with Keith. And so now let's look at the downstream side of what I'm doing. If we can look at how crowding changes the properties, maybe we can now make some predictions about those other proteins that Keith identified that we don't know anything about. Mm-hmm. So that's how proteomics fits into this whole thing.
Okay.
Was there other omicses you wanted to talk about?
Well, you know, I know that there are so many of the technologies have contributed to the rise of these omics, metabolomics, proteomics. Ooh. Even genomics is still certainly progressing rapidly.
Oh, sure, and we're going to learn an awful lot by just having sequences of, you know, other human genome sequences mm-hmm. from other organisms.
And Dr. Watson has his own genome sequence.
That's right.
The first.
Yes, and they're not releasing all of it. That's another interesting thing about that story. There's a couple of genes he does not want people to know so that he can
see.
Oh,
I didn't
insurance.
Hear about that. Oh, that's interesting.
I can't remember what they are, but I think it had to do with triglyceride metabolism.
Okay. Well, you know, that kind of brings up an issue there that I think any of us who had our genome sequenced would have some things in there that we might not want everyone to know about.
Yeah, well, you could devote. You got to find so you could devote like 3 or 4 shows to that whole idea.
Absolutely,
because you know somebody's going to win this prize that you can. What is it? $1,000 for a whole genome?
Right.
Somebody's
right.
going to win that, mm-hmm. and then watch out. We'll probably there's the potential to know much more about you than you want people to know.
Right, or even you want to know.
Yeah.
You know the wonderful explanation you've given us, Gary, of this difference between the globular proteins and the intrinsically disordered proteins. That is a concept I was not familiar with previously, but it's absolutely fascinating, and it just sounds like it opens up a whole complete world rich for study and rich with potential information that would be very valuable.
And the other thing that I'd like to point out is, remember how all this started. People were throwing these proteins away.
Sure.
And that's where a lot of science comes from, a few wackos deciding to work on a particular problem.
Well, of course, we've seen, we were just talking about genomics. Only recently has the term junk DNA started to be outmoded. So, you know, that's certainly to be commended. So where is your research headed from here? You took a break from the lab to come here. What are you going to do when you get back?
Well,
and in the longer term.
Okay. In the short term, it's Wednesday. So on Wednesday, I spent a half hour talking with everybody who works in my laboratory. So I've got a bunch of meetings after this. And then in the bigger picture, making it work, bringing in-cell NMR into eukaryotic cells. And that's going to be one tough nut. But I've got the tools, and now I've got the talent. Thanks to the NIH Pioneer Award.
So what, in terms of nuts and bolts, what has that Pioneer Award allowed you to do? Has it allowed you to add staff and equipment and everything?
I've always said that training students is very important, so I've never had a postdoctoral fellow in my 18 years here.
Is that right?
I now have 2.
Okay.
So, and that's changed my life, because you know, it turns out, Ernie, you don't have to train these guys. They know how to use the spectrometer. They know how to do molecular biology.
Okay.
So that's been a big change. I've got I've got two technicians. In other words, I don't have to make graduate students make DNA and mail plasmids to Germany, or they don't have to, like, purify all their own protein. We have a technician to do that. The room next to my office used to house a circular dichroism instrument. We found a different place for that. Now it's full of all this beautiful cell culture equipment. A lot of things have changed.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things I've heard from grantees in the past is that it allows them to bring functions in-house that previously they would have to go elsewhere to get and, you know, share time on equipment and things like that.
Oh, yes. It makes a lot of difference being able to do it right in your laboratory versus even down the hall. Having equipment close to you makes one heck of a difference in getting things done.
Sure. Well, Gary, we are just about out of time. The hour has passed by very quickly, as it always does. And I certainly want to thank you for taking a break from the lab and wandering over here to Carrboro and sharing your time and expertise with our Radio In Vivo audience today, and wish you the best of luck with this remarkable and very fascinating line of research that you're involved with, looking at proteins in living cells. And as we all know, proteins are, in fact, the essence of life.
Thank you very much, and if you ever need to know anything more about proteins, give me a buzz.
I will do. Well, we have got some terrific guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio In Vivo. We're going to be doing shows about honeybees and umbilical cord blood stem cells. Now, how's that for versatility? You can check the website for the lineup, which is updated regularly as we book new appearances. So we hope you will join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM FM, Carrboro and Chapel Hill. And if you enjoy the program, we certainly encourage you to make an effort to support the station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. See you next time.